now. 4,500.
People are dying.
And you could save a life.
90% of Canadians say they're willing to donate their organs.
But only a few are registered.
So what are you waiting for?
Get registered.
It's easy and it's free.
Leave a legacy.
Be a hero.
Save a life.
Find out how to register today. Go to kidney.ca.
No, we're just trying to win this dance.
Right. You're staying alive on 101.9 with Marco on Astrotop.
We got the Refugees All-Stars, Rubber Devin in the club, Wyclef Jean.
Shorty got back. Should I ask her for a dance? Hold on, there's too many in the wolf pack. And besides, dirty cash talking to her. Buying her fake furs and taking her to the fever.
Welcome, you're listening to CITR 101.9. It's Thursday, it's 3 o'clock, and it's time for another one half hour of astronomy talk with your host Marco on CITR's Astro Talk.
Check the spelling REFUGE. Get the CD from Sam Goody. You ain't even close with the rhymes that you wrote. Don't be mad because you broke. Let me clear my throat.
You're listening to Astro Talk with Marco on CITR 101.9 FM.
Me, I'm eating mangoes in Trinidad with attorneys. Yeah. My food slang flow worldwide like a current. Went to every spot where nobody got insurance.
Good afternoon. This is Marco on CITR 101. You're listening to AstroTalk. Well, lots on the astronomy calendar these days. And the exciting thing last week was on Thursday after my show, I ran over to the physics building and there was a lecture given by Kip Thorne, Dr. Kip Thorne, the noted theoretical astrophysicist. But he's much more than that. He's the father of black holes. Other people are the godfather, but he's the father. So he wrote a book in 1994, which I bought and which I read over and over again. And it's called Black Holes and Time Warps. And the subtitle is Einstein's Outrageous Legacy. So he is an icon in the astrophysical world, and he's one of my heroes. So it was amazing to meet him. He signed my book, and he explained about a lot of things in astrophysics, but he also talked about the detection of the gravitational wave and how he was involved in it. So he, with Professor Bill Unruh from University of British Columbia Physics Department, they were in on the ground floor in developing the Hanford, or the theoretical underpinnings of the legal observatory in Hanford where they detected the gravitational wave. So it was a thrill to listen to Professor Thorne, but of course, most of us are nowhere near his stratosphere in terms of knowledge and eloquence and just having a big universe-sized brain. So that was the highlight of my week last week. Of course, I loved doing the show, but then raced over to see Kip Thorne. So I guess all of you in astronomy know about Kip Thorne. So now I'm going to talk more about Kip Thorne's book. Last time I talked about one of the outrageous legacies of Einstein's general theory of relativity, where Professor Thorne in his book talked about a scientific team is orbiting a black hole. They have a fixed orbit of about 1 million kilometers, and they drop a little robot down into the black hole and see what happens to it. And then one of the people in the spacecraft, they jump in a little separate spacecraft and go further into the black hole and talk about what happens to them as they approach the event horizon or get closer to it. So I'm going to talk about that a bit later, but first, let's talk about the lecture. Well, I couldn't understand a lot of what he said. If I had to repeat it, I could kind of make out what he was saying. He talks in simple speak, so us simple people can understand, but he talked about when the two black holes were merging and the gravitational waves that were detected from it on Earth. And he also talked about when they met in the 80s and the 90s to design this observatory to detect black holes. He talked about certain specs or specifications that the instruments had to have. He had the foresight 20, 30 years ago to correctly predict what kind of specifications these machines that are detecting the gravitational waves have to have. So that's amazing listening to him talk and all the theories that they had back then. So I guess I'll try to see if I can get a copy of his lecture and put it online. Maybe you can contact the physics department. But I'm also going to go within a month, I think. I'm going to go into Washington State in Hanford, where the gravitational wave was detected. I attended a lecture at SFU Surrey a month or two ago, a Saturday morning lecture, where one of the team members, a prominent astrophysicist, Dr. Landry, he was part of the team that detected and discovered the gravitational wave. I met with him after his lecture, and I asked for his card, and since I've been in contact since, and he's invited me down to the observatory. So I'm looking forward to that. I really want to go to Hanford, and he's going to tour me around the observatory, and I can have a nice interview with him. So that's in the future. I'm still trying to get some other astrophysicists on, but these astrophysicists, they are busy. So now I'm going to talk about Kip Thorne's book. So it's an outrageous legacy, and a lot of it was speculation. This book was written in the 90s, so I guess a lot of things have been discovered about black holes. Oh, but first, there's one story that came up April 18th. It's titled NASA's Fermi Telescope Poised to Pin Down Gravitational Wave Sources. There was, I believe, a belief among astrophysicists when black holes merge, there is no other signature, no other light produced. The black holes will swallow them all. There's some of the energy or mass of the two black holes that are converted into gravitational waves. So I believe when the two black holes merged, they were in the order of 30 solar masses each, something like 30 and 35. They lost 4 solar masses in energy, radiating the energy away in gravitational waves. So it was thought that no light could escape, but now NASA's Fermi telescope have detected a signature of gamma rays or gamma rays burst. So half a second after the two black holes merged, which, remember, happened 1.3 billion years ago. So these two black holes are 1.3 billion years away. So they merged 1.3 billion years ago. So it took 1.3 billion years for the signal to reach us. But after half a second after the two black holes merged, the NASA's Fermi telescope picked up a brief, weak burst of high-energy light consistent with the same part of the sky. They said it's almost nil that the pickup of this burst of light was a random coincidence. So the scientists now picked up gamma rays coming from the black hole merger. So they say gamma rays arising from a black hole merger would be a landmark finding because black holes are expected to merge cleanly without producing any sort of light. So says Valerie Knott, a team member at the National Space Science and Technology Center in Huntsville, Alabama. This is a tantalizing discovery with a low chance of being a false alarm. But before we can start rewriting the textbooks, we'll need to see more bursts associated with gravitational waves from black hole mergers. And that what physicists think will happen. If this is true, they will have to rewrite the textbooks. So there's lots of great stuff coming from this gravitational wave that was detected last year. Detecting light from a gravitational wave source will enable a much deeper understanding of the event. Fermi's gamma ray telescope sees the entire sky not blocked by Earth. So some of the light waves that are coming from out there are blocked by our atmosphere, but not X-rays and gamma rays. So they are not blocked by Earth's atmosphere. So with its wide energy range and large field of view, the gamma ray burst, or the Fermi telescope, is the premier instrument for detecting light from short gamma ray bursts, which lasts less than 2 seconds. They are widely thought to occur when orbiting compact objects like neutron stars or black holes spin inward and crash together. These same systems are also suspected to be prime producers of gravitational wave sources. With just one event, gamma rays and gravitational waves together will tell us exactly what causes a gamma ray burst or a short gamma ray burst, something they did not know about. There is an incredible synergy between these two observations, with gamma rays revealing details about the source's energetics and local environment, and the gravitational waves providing a unique probe of the dynamics leading up to the merger of the two black holes. Currently, gravitational wave observatories possess relatively blurry vision. This will improve in time as more facilities begin to operate. But for the September event of last year, dubbed GW150914, LIGO, which is the observatory in Washington State, could only trace the source of an arc spanning an area of about 600 square degrees, comparable to an angular area on Earth occupied by the United States. So it's a very small area. Less than a half a second after the gravitational wave was detected, the Fermi telescope picked up a faint pulse of high-energy X-rays lasting about a second. The burst effectively occurred beneath Fermi at a high angle to the gravitational wave detectors. So Earth blocked a large swath of the burst likely location as seen by Fermi at the time. So there is a high chance now that with the gravitational waves, gamma ray bursts are produced too, something scientists did not think about before. Okay, so now let's go into Kip Thorne's book, Black Holes and Time Warps. So as I said, I read this book 22 years ago. It kept me enthralled. Every night I'd be reading the book, and it was amazing. At that time, some of it was speculation, and I'm sure a lot of things have changed in the intervening 22 years. But there's a lot of history, and one thing that's great about the book is that Kip Thorne links our understanding of neutron stars and the development of neutrons, our theory, how we understand the theory of neutron stars, of black holes, black hole mergers, all these things, which the gravitational wave will definitely give us a deeper understanding of. Kip Thorne talked about something else in the book which caught my attention now that I'm rereading the book, and I just couldn't skip over it. So it's not really to do with science, but it is to do with science. So I'm going to jump right in. In the World War I period, a young grad student headed from India on a boat to London, where he was going to undertake his graduate work. So during that time, now remember when Einstein made a lot of his theory of general relativity, the offshoots of his theory, he couldn't fathom them. He couldn't fathom that stars would explode, that the universe would expand, that black holes would form, that there'd be such things as neutron star. So a lot of physicists really didn't know these things that we take for granted. Today, you could ask a 5-year-old and he'll say, yeah, I know what a black hole is. And it's just things we take for granted. What's a neutron? What's an electron? Well, back in World War I and World War II, not all these things were common knowledge. And what was interesting about this was in World War II, the world was split after World War II between the Soviet world and the West. So there was an arms race, and with the explosion of the bombs in Hiroshima, Japanese say Hiroshima, not Hiroshima, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Soviets were afraid of the nuclear arsenal of the United States. So after the war, the U.S. and the Soviets were thinking, can we trust the other power? The Soviets did not have the bomb. The U.S. had the bomb. So the Americans were afraid, well, what if the Soviets get the bomb? And the Soviets were afraid, well, look, We lost 27 million people in World War II. Stalin, during the 30s, 40s, and 50s, he had great purges where tens of millions of people they died. They were put into labor camps or just murdered. So the Soviet Union probably lost 50 million people, and there's a lot of insecurity there. And with a leader like Stalin, who the Soviets, maybe some of them, thought he was a good leader, he was a great leader, the West was fearful of a guy like Stalin. What if you put a nuclear bomb into the hands of somebody who kills 10, 20, 30 million of his own people? So there was all these things happening. But during World War II, a lot of the great minds, whether it was in the Soviet Union or whether it was in America, a lot of the physicists, a lot of the astrophysicists, a lot of the physicists too with nuclear things, they were all put to work in the war effort. So not a lot of discoveries took place in astronomy, but there was a lot of work going on in developing weapon systems. And in the Soviet Union, the 1941, they were fighting the Nazis. But the Russians knew that during World War II, the Americans were working on the nuclear bomb. And Americans were also afraid, well, what if Hitler gets a nuclear bomb? And they were also thinking, well, what happens if Stalin gets a nuclear bomb? So there were all these fears. So America, they dropped the two nuclear bombs in Japan, the only two times that nuclear bombs have been used. So the Soviets started, I think it even started in World War II, a no-holds-barred program to get that nuclear research done. So with the U.S. explosion of a uranium-239 bomb, Stalin berated the Soviet scientists. He berated them by saying, I demand that we now have a no-holds-bar crash project to get the bomb. And a person called Beria, I don't have his first name here, he was the head of the secret police, he was put in charge of this. So as I said, during the war, the Soviets lost a lot of people to in the fight with the Nazis. And with Stalin's purges, tens of millions were executed or died in Soviet prison camps. So what Stalin did, he commanded the forced labor of millions of Soviets for his prison camps. So what he did, they were called Zeks, and his goal was to do uranium-239 research. So whole cities were built just to bake a uranium bomb. So your uranium purification factories, nuclear reactors, theoretical research centers, weapon test centers. And so they were all contained in self-contained small cities far away from other cities. These were all secret places. They were called Objekt, which is called installation. So here we have an arms race starting. The Soviet Union wants to go all out because it is so afraid of the Americans. So when I return, we're going to do more on this. And I'm reading this all from Kip Thorne's work. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on 101.9.
The most beautiful thing about my burrow is the stillness. I must have slept for all my passages. And it must have this been noise, very, however, is all of silence and is hear only as a faint whistle. I did not hear it all in the night. I was on the wind, although it must have certainly been there. Can my and it is so much speed, audible only to the ear of the householder. It seemed to me that the beast has ever even heard me. It simply cannot have heard me, for all that time I kept very quiet, that I dug the experimental trenches. The Burrow, hosted by Andy Resto. Mondays from 3 to 4 p.m. Alternative music, noise things, artist interviews, honest discussions, levity. Because music doesn't need to be fun. On CITR 101.9 FM and CITR.ca.
Fresh off the runway, pair white night. with Marco on Astro Talk on CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. This is Marco on Astro Talk on 101.9. So I'm getting back to this World War II thing about the nuclear bombs. And this is all a lead-in into astrophysicists, into astrophysics, believe it or not. So here we are. It's the 1940s, and there's an arm race starting because the world is dividing into two blocks, the communist bloc and the Western world. So Stalin puts all his people to work. So he commanded forced labor of millions of Soviets. So they were slave laborers. From Stalin's prison camps, he put them all to work to make the bomb. So he constructed things called ZECs, these forced labor camps, to purify uranium, to do the research, to make nuclear reactors, theoretical research, weapons tests, all these things. And at the same time, the Americans were perfecting their designs of the bomb. So they had ready made two bombs, and making a bomb is really not that easy, believe it or not. So when the nuclear bombs, especially the hydrogen bombs in the 50s, when they were in the design stage, there was a disagreement as to how to design it. Because again, you don't go to a textbook and in a topic that people don't know anything about. So in the 40s and 50s, not a lot was known about black holes, neutron stars, or how to design weapons. But there was a link, because the way you design nuclear weapons, the way they explode, the computer programs would be useful later in terms of making models of how stars implode. So at this time in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, not a lot of people believed that a star could implode, that you could have a supernova. There was research by someone called Zwicky, and he predicted that, yes, stars could implode. And Chandrasekhar, the Indian grad student who went to London to do his master's and PhD, he thought they could, but his professor at Eddington, while letting Chandrasekhar use his calculator, looked over Chandrasekhar's shoulders and saw the research Chandrasekhar was doing on black holes and neutron stars and things like that, and it countered his theories. So when Chandrasekhar came out in the lecture with his theories, Eddington stood up and said, "This is preposterous," because Eddington had such prestige at that time. A lot of physicists were forced to go in line behind him, even though they believed Chandrasekhar. So the development of black hole theory and neutron stars theory was not only halted by World War I or World War II, it was halted by scientists that didn't believe in it. How could a star implode? How could there be enough pressure? How could this happen? How could that happen? So even Einstein doubted some of the outcomes of his theories of general relativity. For example, gravitational waves. He predicted them in the 1910s, but then later in the 1930s, he tried to talk other scientists into not believing in them. He said, "No, I don't think you could get a gravitational wave." But the scientists shot back and said, "Yes, we can." So anyway, there was a lot of things. Political, there was prestige, and there was the war effort. So these were all getting in the way of research on neutron stars, on black holes, as talked about in Kip Thorne's book, Black Holes and Time Warps, Einstein's Outrageous Legacy. So again, this is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on 101.9. So what happened now? We have the World War, World War II. A lot of Soviets are put into forced labor camps, millions of them, to develop the bomb. Stalin took all the resources of his country, almost all of them, and said, "We have to build a bomb. We can't let America develop the bomb," which they already did, and then let America threaten us with a nuclear bomb. So Stalin said, "We have to make our own bomb." So Soviet spies were also at work acquiring nuclear secrets that the U.S. had, because one of their astrophysicists from Britain, he's a U.K. astrophysicist, he went to the U.S., Klaus Fuchs, Fuchs, F-U-C-H-S, he went in to the U.S. to work on the nuclear bomb program in the U.S. during World War II. So when he went back to London, the Soviets acquired secrets from him about the U.S. Design of their nuclear bomb. The Soviet design was different, though. So that's one of the difficult things. We think, oh, yeah, boy, it's common knowledge now how to design a bomb. But in the 30s and the 40s, in the 50s, no one knew how to design these bombs. And so the Soviets had one design, and when they found out that their design was different than America's, they copied the American design. They only had enough nuclear fuel for one bomb, so they used the U.S. design, because if you fail with Stalin, then he executes you. So after 4 years of crash efforts, untold deaths of slave laborers in the ZECs, that's what they were called, the slave labor camps, untold misery of the slave workers where they were forced to slave away day and night in these cold cities to build the nuclear bomb, and the building of nuclear reactors and the waste from it. In August 29, 1949, the Soviets finally exploded a nuclear bomb. The first Soviet bomb exploded near Semipalatinsk in Soviet Asia, where they were making the nuclear fuel. In the 1990s, Chelyabinsk, there was an explosion in the 1990s which contaminated the area around it. So we didn't know about this in the West, but later we found out that the Soviets had these forced labor camps to build nuclear bombs. So in late 1949, August 1949, the Soviets exploded a bomb, and in September 1949, a U.S. WB-29 weather reconnaissance plane found signatures of the Soviet tests. So this caused panic in the U.S. There was talk of backyard bomb shelters, atomic bomb drills at school, McCarthyism, get out the spies. And so there was now a debate. Some scientists wanted to build a super bomb. The bomb that was dropped in Hiroshima in World War II was a fission bomb. So you break apart uranium-239. When you break it apart, it releases energy and you get an explosion. But the new kind of bomb they wanted to build was a hydrogen bomb, where you fuse hydrogen together to get helium. So you could make this bomb as powerful as one wished. You can even make it 1 million times the power of Hiroshima. So this was a scary bomb. It was called a super weapon. It was in a totally different category than the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So there was now a debate in the United States, debate on how to make the bomb, what's designed, but also one of the prominent physicists, Oppenheimer, he was opposed to the bomb just on ethical principles. He said, how can we build these bombs that's a million times stronger than Hiroshima, drop it on a city and destroy a whole city of innocent people? Not only that, if you drop a few of these bombs, radioactivity could contaminate the whole earth. So there was this big debate going on in the U.S., where in Russia there was forced labor camps to build the bomb. And so it was a different ballgame, where the Soviets were trying at all costs to build a bomb. They got the atomic bomb. Then they realized there's a hydrogen bomb, and they were afraid if the Americans get it. So this is the start of the arms race, isn't it? And the Americans were afraid, well, what if the Soviets explode a bomb? Which they did. So basically here we have the start of an arms race. And there was ethical considerations in the U.S. Can we build this kind of bomb that will destroy the world or destroy whole cities, like millions of people? Can we do that? So after a lot of debate in the U.S., Harry S. Truman, in March 10th, 1950, he pushes for a crash program to design a super bomb. So there was two teams, one at Los Alamos and one at Princeton. So what happened when design of the super bomb, this is significant because the computer programs that they use for designing the bomb and the theory in how bombs explode could later be translated to how neutron stars explode, how black holes form, how stars explode, and big stars, that is, and then later form into neutron stars or black holes. So there was this great history of, well, I don't think it's a great history, but a major history on how they used for years all the research on all the nuclear research on how to design a